This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dr. Marianne Legato, is a specialist in women's health. I don't mean gynecology. She co-founded a center at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons that's dedicated to helping doctors understand the unique needs of women patients in every aspect of their health care, from headaches to heart attacks. Dr. Legato is also an internist with a private practice. She's written extensively on heart disease in women and how it is often misdiagnosed. That was the subject of her first book, The Female Heart. Her new book is a more general examination of women's health issues called What Women Need to Know. I asked Dr. Legato why she thinks it's necessary to have a separate branch of medicine for women.
We don't envision it as a separate branch at all. But traditionally, we have done most or all of our research on men or on male subjects. We have therefore extrapolated the data directly to women without modification and without studying most of our observations directly in women. So we have a male model of normal human biology in many respects, and we certainly have a male model of most diseases, particularly, for example, coronary artery disease, in which virtually all investigation has been done traditionally in men.
And you make a really good point in your earlier book about women and heart disease, which is that if a man gets chest pains, he's like rushed to the hospital and people assume he's having a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
If a woman has chest pains, what happens?
Unfortunately, physicians are twice as likely to dismiss women's symptoms as emotional or in their heads as they are identical symptoms of a coronary artery disease in a man.
Now, I have to say, this is anecdotal evidence, but I know a lot more men who have had heart trouble than women, and a lot more older men who have had heart bypass surgery than I know women who've had it. So it just, like, anecdotally, it actually would seem to me that men have more heart problems than women.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, that's such a popular misconception. It is true that more men than women have coronary artery disease, which is what we're talking about, until the last decades of life in which women surpass men in the incidence of coronary artery disease. But I think the important fact to emphasize, Terry, is this. 500,000 American women are dying in the United States annually of cardiovascular disease. A little over 260,000 are dying of all cancers combined, and under 50,000 a year are dying of breast cancer. So that sort of, I think, refocuses where women's attention should be. Most women, when they're asked what they most fear, will answer without blinking an eye, breast cancer. They think they're most likely to die of breast cancer, and they don't consider, nor do many of the physicians caring for them, unfortunately, that heart disease is a significant enemy. So that's the illusion that we're trying to correct.
Is heart disease most likely to strike women when they're older, in their 70s or 80s?
In general, heart disease, coronary artery disease, appears a decade later than it does in men. Men begin to exhibit coronary artery disease at about the age of 35 in meaningful numbers. But between 40 and 60, as many women die of heart disease as die of breast cancer. Hmm. By the age of 60, a woman is as likely to have a heart attack as is a man.
I think a lot of people assume that since women appear to be under so much more stress now because they're holding down jobs plus raising children and taking care of the house, that the kind of pressures that men were under that maybe helped bring on heart attacks, women are under now too.
I happen to love that question.
Okay. Is there any truth to that? Uh-huh.
Let me tell you something. You know, I have had that said to me so often. I'll finish a talk and a man will stand up in the audience and he will say, well, of course you're having more heart disease now than you had before. And of course that's becoming an issue. You're starting to feel the same kinds of stresses that we are. The laughable fact is the following. Women who work and feel rewarded by their work. They enjoy it. They feel rewarded by it, either socially or personally or financially rewarded, and who have no other major responsibilities are at the lowest risk of coronary artery disease, which I think is fascinating. Women whom the Framingham study has characterized as pink-collar workers, that is, women who are in jobs in which they feel invisible or under-rewarded or just sort of tools of the boss for whom they are working, in fact, have an increased risk compared to the average woman for coronary artery disease. Women at the highest risk for coronary artery disease are those who combine unrewarding work with the responsibilities of child rearing. So the interesting truth about work is that it's actually preventive and a good thing to do if, in fact, you're not stressed by conflicting responsibilities and if you feel that the work is exciting and rewarding.
So how is this affecting how doctors treat women for heart problems?
Well, I think that the whole issue of how physicians treat women for heart problems is fascinating. I have just finished a manuscript written in collaboration with Prevention Magazine experts on a survey that looked at women's perception of what was their most important health enemy, and also what advice or preventive medicine they were receiving from their physicians. And one of the scariest things about that survey in 1996, after my book and all the efforts I and many, many others of my colleagues have done to inform women and the physicians who care for them about the dangers of heart disease for women, I was quite personally disappointed to see that a very high percentage of physicians never mention heart disease to their female patients as a health threat or as something against which they should be taking preventive medicine or changing their lifestyles, even to women over 60, which I thought was pretty amazing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Marianne Legato, and she's the author of the new medical book, What Women Need to Know, and she directs the Partnership for Women's Health at Columbia. What are some of the questions that women ask you that they seem most uncomfortable asking their own doctors?
I think the most frequent questions I hear, if I give a woman enough time and enough comfort to ask, are questions about sexuality, self-image, how to reduce stress, how to care better for family members, and right at the end of the list, questions about personal appearance that seem to be things that they're shy about asking.
Well, give me an example of personal appearance questions that you'd ask a doctor.
Well, many women who are reaching the 40 to 50 decade worry about their sexual desirability or their attractiveness, particularly if they've had a divorce or a recent separation. And they often ask my opinion about liposuction and facelifts, not only where to go, but do I think it's important, which is kind of an interesting question and one I welcome.
And do you think it's important? And is it something that you advise, liposuction or plastic surgery?
What I advise is to have the best sense of yourself that it's possible to have. You know, I've always believed that personal attractiveness was much more related to the affection of the beholder than it was to symmetry of features. Think of the person you most admire, and I really don't think that it matters whether that person is sort of authentically beautiful or certifiably beautiful. It's really your response to them that characterizes the relationship. So I'd like to get the focus off personal appearance for women in general and into what they mean to the people around them. However, performers, for example, depend a great deal on personal appearance, and that's kind of a different situation. So I think I try to tailor the answer to the person asking the question.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about one of the more controversial issues in women's health for women who are middle-aged, and that is hormone replacement therapy. Do you have a strong pro or con stand on that?
Well, you know, that's the question that women over 45 or thereabouts who are called perimenopausal, those women looking at the specter as they see it of menopause, and those who are going through menopause most frequently ask me. And yes, I do have a point of view. First of all, I think every woman ought to know what indications there are in her individual case for using hormones, and there might be one of several. And here are some of the things that a woman should rate herself on or think about. Estrogen does not only work on the reproductive system. It has an effect on almost every tissue of the body, and that effect is, for example, very marked in the brain. where it helps the brain maintain what's called plasticity. We develop new neuronal connections in our brain whenever we remember something new or see something new. We need estrogen, we believe, and those of us who have looked at it, to maintain the ability of the brain to function clearly and to remember things. And so in women who describe to me, as one of my very good friends did, I have fuzzy thinking since this menopause, I'd like to recommend a trial for estrogen replacement for impaired memory, particularly for names or things, or walking, the kind of woman who walks into a room and says, "What did I come in here for? I here I am and I can't remember why I'm here." I think that estrogen might be considered for that particular symptom. The second is intolerable symptoms of menopause that are quite traditional, like drenching hot sweats, particularly if they occur at night. Women often describe those of who are disturbed by hot flashes, or hot flushes as they're called, waking up sometimes every 3 or 4 minutes with a sensation of overwhelming warmth and then drenching sweat that follows. That is what I would call one of the intolerable symptoms of menopause, and a woman might very easily find those treated quite adequately by estrogen. Women who are assessed for estrogen replacement should also have their bone density measured. And there's a very good test to do that now. It takes about 45 minutes. I myself just had one. And the actual density or thickness of bones at strategic points, usually your spine, your hip, and your wrist, is measured. If that is low as compared to women of the same age, in my patient, I would recommend a trial of estrogen as one of the possible therapies for osteoporosis, as it's called, or thinning bones. The third and most exciting area, I think, on the horizon is that we now know, through the work of Philip Sorrell and a group of his colleagues in England and in other areas of the world, that estrogen stabilizes the coronary arteries of women, and that some women who are experiencing odd chest pain and palpitations as part of their menopausal symptoms respond to estrogen replacement. So I think, to cut to the conclusion, each woman should be individually assessed for her need for hormonal replacement therapy. You know, 20% of women who have menopausal who are at menopause, or 20% of women who undergo menopause, do not need hormonal replacement therapy. The remaining 80% have to be carefully looked at to see whether, in fact, the benefits to them will outweigh the risks.
What are the risks of hormonal replacement therapy, and which women do you think should avoid it?
Well, the risk most people are concerned about who come to my office for information is the risk of cancer. Now, we know that if we give estrogen alone, that there is a very high likelihood that women will develop cancer of the uterus. This risk for cancer of the uterus with estrogen therapy is almost completely extinguished if the woman is given progesterone along with the estrogen. Some women take progesterone every day. Some women take it only for a part of their cycle. But I do not believe that hormonal replacement therapy, if it's properly given, will cause cancer of the uterus. There is a small increase in the risk for breast cancer in women who use hormonal replacement therapy who are over 60 and who have used it for 5 years or longer, according to the nurse's study.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Marianne Legato, and she directs the Partnership for Women's Health at Columbia. She's also the author of a new medical information book for women called What Women Need to Know. Dr. Legato, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Marianne Legato, author of the new medical book, What Women Need to Know, and director of the Partnership for Women's Health at Columbia. Dr. Legato, I assume you teach at Columbia.
I do. I love it.
Good. Well, I'm wondering how what you teach about women's health compares to what you were taught about women's health.
Was I ever taught about women's health? Women's health in medical school for me in the 60s was, here's what you have to know about women, which entirely had to do with their reproductive systems. Mm-hmm. That's all we studied, was the pelvis. I found out only through treating women and taking care of patients that there was, as I like to say, life above the pelvis, and that women, in fact, had brains that think, hearts that beat. And all of female biology deserves a careful look. There are so many aspects of female biology that are unique and that are different from that of men. I have just written a little book called Gender-Specific Aspects of Human Biology for the Practicing Physician, and it really surveys in a quick way for the practicing physician how different men and women are. And not just in their reproductive systems, but in fact, the anatomy and function of the human brain is different in men and women. The electrical properties of their hearts in some respects are different. The sizes of their hearts is different. The normal function of bowel is different in men and women. And some of the most important characteristics of the skin differs between men and women.
Go ahead.
Finally, the way men and women metabolize drugs can be dramatically different. So I think that, as the great Florence Hazeltine, one of my most respected and admired colleagues, has been heard to say, if men had any sense, they'd be studying women. I think that those of us who are involved in this partnership are convinced that there are great gaps in our information about normal human function because we have studied only one gender, and that as we look at the natural experiment and use it in our clinical research of two genders, we will learn a much more complete picture of how human beings function, of how to treat disease more accurately, and indeed of how disease works in a much more accurate fashion.
Maybe you could tell us about some of the differences between the man and the woman medically. What's most intriguing to you right now?
Well, it may sound funny, but one of the most intriguing differences to me is that there are differences in the salivary composition, in the substances that are in the saliva of men and women, and that furthermore, the salivary composition of women differs with the phases of her menstrual cycle. To me, that was an amazing revelation. And it struck me that people, for example, making toothpaste might not have taken that into consideration when they made a toothpaste.
So what does that mean functionally if your saliva is different?
We don't know. I think it's just an observation. Uh-huh. And one of the important questions comes,
right,
once you know about this difference, what is the next question to ask? Does it in fact mean that women have an advantage over men with regard to tooth decay or plaque formation or digestion of their foods? Are there foods that are easier for women to digest than men? Who knows?
So tell me some of the things that you're telling your students now about women's health, things that you wish somebody had told you.
I think that one of the things I hope I'm telling my students is that women are complete human beings, and that's not a facetious remark, that a female patient should be approached with the same thoroughness and the head-to-toe assessment that male patients should. You know, traditionally, when our daughters get to be 18 and go off to college, we send them to the gynecologist, and the gynecologist is responsible for most of their care, or all of it, until the first medical crisis arises that is not about their menstrual cycle or something associated with their reproductive life. Our sons, we kind of leave to the sports docs or the coach until the first medical problem arises. The people who are giving the best comprehensive care to boys, to men and women, or males and females, in fact, are the pediatricians, if you really think about it. When you take your baby for a general checkup, girls get the same kind of general going over that boys do. I think it's not a bad model for adults to be looking for in their medical care. Don't you think that's kind of interesting?
Yeah, I do. Do you think that there's going to come a time when there's one group of doctors that treat men and another group that treat women?
I sure hope not. I am not for ghettoizing women's medicine into a separate specialty. I want to mainstream women into the best medicine available and have them have the same general, thorough approach with a profound appreciation of the uniqueness of men and women. I want them to be treated by the best, And I think that women should not be segmented off into a specialty which only a few are entitled to practice. I think they should be part of the general run of, may I say, mankind, and be exposed to the best medicine there is. We need to benefit from our information that women give us as patients and as the objects of our care or the subjects of our care. And I think to make a separate specialty of women's health may have very unfortunate consequences. It will not do at all what I hope we do, which is integrate women into the way we take care of patients so that we can learn from them and apply the lessons that they teach us to the way we treat all patients.
Well, Dr. Marianne Legato, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure to chat. I hope it's been helpful.
Dr. Marianne Legato co-founded the Partnership for Women's Health at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. Her new book on women's health is called What Women Need to Know. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.